Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. I'm Brian. I'm here with Aaron.
Hello.
And welcome to episode 12 of the Cloudcast. We're coming to you from our massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And today, we're bringing back Cloudcast alumni and now president of the Platform Cloud, Christian Riley. Hey, Christian, how you been?
Hey, guys. How are you? I've been great. Thank you.
Last time we talked to you, so we had you on sort of our first official podcast way back in February. You've been all over the place. You've been traveling. You've been going to events. Where you been?
Oh, man, where haven't I been? I guess most recently I was at the GlueCon over there in Broomfield, Colorado, which was a really cool event. And before that, I was at Interop, Enterprise Cloud Summit, man, you name it. I feel like I've not been off a plane for months.
And you've been doing a mix of sort of learning. I know, you know, the GlueCon's kind of the API summit, right? It's the big API conference.
Yeah, right. Yeah, a little bit unusual given my background. But yeah, it was really interesting to see what's going on there. You know, I think everybody's kind of trying to figure out where APIs go. It's become a real hot topic given the fact that you know, you've got all sorts of things springing up with all sorts of APIs, not just from the kind of the endpoint perspective, meaning, you know, the kind of the Twitters, the Netflixes, whatever, but also in the management space, which I guess we'll cover today, and that's getting pretty interesting in and of itself.
Absolutely. So yeah, we're going to dig into cloud management tonight. Aaron, how you been, man? It's been a week or so. How you been?
Been real good, real good. Had kind of a hellacious travel week last week, so we actually had to postpone podcast due to actually my travel delays. But finally got some rest this weekend and ready to go.
Now what's this? What the hell is this mud thing you're going to do?
The mud run. I signed up in September. It's actually a 10K race, but they call it a mud run. So you're doing a 10K race. But it's also boot camp style obstacles, like the rope bridges and climbing under things and running through big pits of mud and all of that. It'll probably take, I don't know, an hour or two, and I'm so out of shape, I'm just hoping to finish. So yeah, I'm actually started training today for the race in September.
Basically, it's going to kill you.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there involved drinking or donuts or anything?
Since I am running the race, yes, absolutely. As I drink some beer right now.
I tell you guys, after going to all these conferences recently, I'm trying to decide that I should ever drink again.
Yeah, nothing packs on the pounds faster or makes you become an alcoholic quicker than going to all these conferences, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you go with Sam Johnston, it gets 10 times quicker.
Yeah, wouldn't that in essence mean you'd have to turn in your English passport and essentially become, it's in your blood, man. You can't be giving up drinking, really, can you?
No, that's true, actually. Given the fact that I'm partly Irish as well, that would be a double whammy, wouldn't it? So.
Christian, you outed Hoff this week. How did that come about?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So that was kind of interesting. I sort of hadn't meant to do that in the way that it came out. But that's, you know what, that's one of the things about Twitter, right? There's an instant nature of it that you kind of sit there and think, well, that didn't quite go to plan. But yeah, good old Hoff, eh? He's gone to Juniper, so... I think it's great for him. I hope everybody knows that by the time this podcast comes out. But no, but good for him.
You know, more than 12 hours. So that's good.
He'll kind of turn it back around to conferences for a second. Out of all of the conferences and all the traveling you've been doing, what did you learn the most? What was the biggest takeaway from all the different conferences you've been attending?
So you know, I guess the biggest thing I took away from it is that, you know, if you kind of look at on balance, I would say there's a marked change in what I see from, you know, kind of people just putting the word cloud up there to be, you know, in from a vendor perspective, in line with, you know, kind of everything's got to be cloud. I think there's a real, real sense of this. A lot of stuff has actually been achieved, but it's balanced with a kind of a new sense of inquisitiveness around what is there to be done. And let me just kind of clarify that for a minute. But so at the Enterprise Cloud Summit that was just at the start of Interop, Alistair Crawl did a great job of getting this event together, and I did a couple of panels there and kind of watched everything that was going on. And, you know, the place was packed, and that was pretty good in and of itself. You know, it wasn't packed with vendors. It was packed with people who were from all different walks of life, you know, trying to understand where they need to be, you know, relative to some of the things that they can do with cloud, and that's from a right the way from an IaaS to an SaaS perspective. And I think the fact that's so well attended, and the fact that the topics and the presentations, the material were so real world, I think that really told me that this hype stuff is kind of over around cloud relative to, you know, is it real, is it not? I think it's very real because there was enough examples of things that had been done. You know, with all sorts of different people. Guys from Boeing, for example, talking about what they've been doing with AWS. That's one example. And then, you know, a bunch of questions of all the panels around what should we do to get our cloud strategy off the ground? And, you know, we're at this position or we're at that position. You know, and people, you know, IT professionals really, really, really looking at this stuff and saying, hey, you know, we think it can make a difference. We want to know more about it and, you know, trying to find their way. So I think the biggest thing I took away from it is that it's, you know, we're probably at a really good place relative taking away all that cloud washing stuff and actually getting on with some real cool stuff.
And if we reach the point where we are starting to see in cloud differences between IaaS and PaaS and SaaS and all these other things, are we starting to actually see those differences come out? And are we starting to see any leading candidate or one technology or example being more mature than any of the others?
Well, that's a good question. You know, yeah, there was a lot of stuff, you know, especially at Interop around platform as a service. And of course, there was a fair bit about it talked about at GlueCon as well. You know, I would say just because of where we are, you know, the IaaS stuff is way more mature. I'll probably get people, you know, from Engine Yard or wherever throwing rocks at me and whatever for saying that. But I think just on balance, I mean, in terms of it, you know, kind of install and used base, I would say that, you know, private cloud stuff, public cloud stuff from an IaaS perspective is far more mature, even though it's not mature in terms of the other technology landscapes we could talk about. But, you know, I think it was really interesting to see what the guys at Cloud Foundry, you know, with VMware are doing, what the guys at OpenShift have done, which is, of course, is the Red Hat's acquisition of Macra, where that's headed. Some of the things that are in there that have been going on from AWS around Beanstalk and whatnot. And then, of course, you know, who knows where the Heroku stuff will go now that it's in the Salesforce stable and whatnot. You know, and I think very interestingly on the platform side is the kind of the recent announcement from Microsoft relative to Fujitsu now being able to provide the first non-Microsoft instantiation of Azure, which I think could be very interesting in and of itself. You know, I mean, it's great. And I think if you kind of look at it, it's going to be a natural thing people to, you know, to implement any of these, whether it's I, P or S as a service, depending on what it is you're trying to achieve. You know, some things will be easier to do than others. It's a very interesting space. And I think, you know, whether it'll be a two-horse race eventually between, or three-horse race, I guess, between Azure, Cloud Foundry and OpenShift will depend on, you know, the jostling that comes up in the platform space over the coming months.
Sure, absolutely. And so if you mention, or we kind of all just for the sake of argument right now, kind of agree that IaaS is the leading candidate here, at least for now, or the most mature candidate. Once we get above and beyond the basic architecture and implementation and actually standing something up, we start to move into, oh God, we got to manage this thing. And what are we going to do now that we're past day one, right? What are some of the trends towards the management of hypervisors of infrastructure? What are you seeing out there today?
So, you know, I think it's pretty interesting. I think I've got it clear in my mind. Not that that really means a lot. But just to sort of try and maybe phrase it for anybody that's listening and trying to struggle with this a little bit. But, you know, the way I look at it is relatively straightforward. Now, I look at hypervisors themselves, which essentially help to manage physical resources. And I say manage, you know, whatever that means in the context of be able to do a better job of physical service. Let's look at it that way. And so, you know, whether that be Zen Server, whether that be ESXi, whether that be KVM, or whether it be, you know, whatever else, Hyper-V, whatever else is out there. I think that's kind of the level that I start at now when I try and sort of think about this and explain it. And I say those hypervisors are the place where I get virtual machines. So I look at it that way very simply. And then I look above that and I say, well, okay, so if I want to create a cloud, now you can argue this public, private, whatever, but let's just kind of stick to the notion of the level above the hypervisor. So if I want to be able to manage hypervisors and create a cloud that allows me to do that, you know, I'm then into looking at orchestration and automation frameworks that are to me definitely a level above the hypervisor and in a space all of their own. So, you know, in that you've got things like cloud.com, you've got Nimbula, you've got Eucalyptus, you've got Abaco, you've got Cloudpeer, you've got OpenStack, of course. And so I would say that that's the kind of level that you use to manage hypervisors. So, you know, once you've got hypervisors, and I use the plural there because I think it's critically important that each of those layers above the hypervisor can actually manage all of the hypervisors. And if you want to spend some time on explaining why I think that, we can go back to that. I would argue then that, you know, relative to a simple explanation, once you've done that, middle layer for management, you've then got a cloud. So my cloud, in that case, that enables me to manage multiple hypervisors and therefore multiple VMs underneath that. And then I think there's another layer above it, which is kind of an interesting space of itself, which helps me to manage clouds. So now I need something at the top that helps me to manage clouds, and I would look there to maybe an Nstratus or a WriteScale. So something that will allow me to sort of abstract even further if you built this thing as a layer cake. So, you know, now at the top I've got cloud management and governance, which then manages clouds, which are these things that manage hypervisors, and then of course the hypervisors manage the physical resources underneath it. So if that makes any sense, that's kind of how I lay it out in my own mind.
It's a big cloud of clouds at the top.
Well, yeah, kind of, you know, because the good bit about the very top of it, of course, is that then you can manage both public and private and hybrid and whatever else you want, because, you know, as long as the management tool you're using can interface with the very expansive APIs that you get from most of the middleware guys, you know, be that cloud.com, you know, Nimbula, whoever they are, then yeah, I mean, I think it's an okay space to be in as a user of this, because, you know, those guys at the top are doing all the heavy lifting in terms of, you know, they're the guys that concentrate on how to interface with the APIs of the middleware guys, and that's not something I need to worry about as an ops guy or an engineer or an architect, because somebody else is doing that for me.
Let's take a couple of examples that you've worked with. Let's take something like cloud.com as a manager of hypervisors, if you will. It's going to give you visibility to storage. It's going to give you visibility to your virtual machines, or at least abstracting the virtual machine manager. Compare that to like what you deal with when you're trying to set up instances with AWS, because, I mean, that's in essence abstracted to Zen Server VMs. The network underneath it, you can tweak to certain extents depending on if you're just building instances, you're trying to do VPNs or VPCs and so forth. How similar are those two sort of worlds in terms of the commercial products, if you will, that are out there versus maybe somebody like AWS who's pretty darn good at the automation and hiding a lot of stuff?
Well, you've kind of nailed it at the end there. You know, I mean, big difference, of course, when you're doing something like an AWS deployment versus a cloud.com thing, is that, you know, the cloud.com thing, if you make the assumption that automating and orchestrating my enterprise data center or data centers, then, you know, obviously I've still got that whole underneath the cloud.com piece relative to Zen Server, and I still have to manage, you know, the kind of the provisioning of the initial pieces of the Zen Server, and then, you know, I attach the cloud stack component to it, and, you know, from there on in I can add more sets of resources from the cloud stack perspective, but somebody has to do that, you know, kind of further down the chain or further to the left or whichever way you want to look at it. There's a big difference relative to burden, if you want to call it that, because obviously in AWS, you know, the only thing I see is the browser interface and then all the services that I want, whether it be, you know, in an EC2 instance or some S3 storage or EBS or an Elastic IP and yada 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 forever. I don't worry about any of those things behind the scenes, you know. All I worry about is, hey, here's what I want, and it just appears. So from a kind of a conceptual perspective, though, as maybe, you know, not as deep in the operational pieces of it, but just as a user of that, it's incredibly similar. You know, if I was just a line of business user, for example, and I wanted to spin up a VM and attach some storage, you know, most of which smart guys in big organizations can do, kind of the look and feel, if you like, is not terribly different. I think that's great from the point of view of the fact that there's obviously the UIs are different, but the general concepts are the same. So, you know, I start a VM, I attach storage, I can do snapshots, I can do backups, those kind of things, but also use snapshots as backups. So all that's kind of in there. But, you know, again, as I say, it's different because somebody somewhere in a private environment is worrying about physical resource management, whereas obviously in AWS, that's completely abstracted away from
you. So let me ask you this. When, if I'm that line of business user you're referring to, and we're talking about self-service portal, provisioning, anything like that, what do you see the most demand for typically? It's going to be the infrastructure, it's going to be the applications, or is it going to be like the settings in the applications, like say a Salesforce.com, where I only need to see this region of this big huge database or this pipeline of sales generation? When it comes to those self-service requests, what are you seeing out there right now?
So, you know, that's a great question. And so let me answer it in sort of two ways. What we're seeing right now is, I would say, the units of currency are compute and storage. And I'll use the term EBS as an example of internal block storage that gets allocated for, you know, attaching to a running VM. That's kind of the most part today, and I think that's primarily due to the way that our applications are, and also due to the way that the current suite of tools that we've employed don't necessarily allow for very simple grouping of VMs as applications. I'm going to dwell on that for a minute because I think this is critically important just in general. So, you know, VMware do an okay job of this with VApp. I'm not convinced it's the best thing I've ever seen, but that's okay for now, I guess. But for most large organizations and most big enterprises, my guess is that they don't deal with multi-tenancy in the way that Salesforce do. So, you know, the average application workload that we come across, and I know it's the same in other big organizations, usually is multiple VMs that go together to make that application. You know, that may be three VMs, it may be six, it may be nine, it may be whatever. I mean, the only multi-tenancy you really see, and I could argue that this really isn't multi-tenancy, is usually at the database tier, where, you know, you have an instance within the database rather than a separate database server as a unit per application. And so that was primarily one of the reasons why we looked at that sort of, you know, the higher level management stuff, because there are tools out there that deal with that today. But I think that's an emerging space. And even with VApp, you know, it's kind of okay at what it does. But, you know, I think if you then build in some additional intelligence in there, so, you know, the spaces where the ops code guys are with Chef or where the guys are with Puppet, I think that's got quite a long way to go in the enterprise space, because if you talk to people like John Willis and whoever else who've been around that area for a while, you know, they'll tell you it's all about DevOps. And I don't disagree with that, absolutely. But there's not many enterprise applications that I've come across that are ready for that kind of DevOps environment for a bunch of reasons, not just because of Chef and Puppet, but, you know, for a bunch of operational and cultural and all sorts of technical reasons that sort of prevent that today.
And let me ask you this, in multi-tenancy, a lot of people don't really think about this, but if you really sit down and think about it, multi-tenancy has almost as many definitions as cloud in the fact that where do you split it, right? And you brought up an awesome, awesome point with the database, because does multi-tenancy mean you're sharing the physical infrastructure, the network, the storage, the compute layers, but you're carving everything up in a secure multi-tenant way? Or can you share things like a database or something else like that that is actually a more of a soft asset? And so absolutely multi-tenancy is, again, something that's very hard to pin down.
Yeah, you know, and I think it adds another level of complexity in my mind, you know, relative to if I'm dealing with a stack that's, you know, got a database, middleware, web, whatever, and each of the components that make up that application in that stack are individual VMs, then it's actually a lot easier to deal with, because, you know, I've kind of got everything where I need it. I can move it around, I can scale it if it can be scaled, and blah, blah, blah. But then when I'm dealing with the database bit of being slightly different from a configuration perspective, meaning that it's, you know, you take another piece of space within the existing database framework, then somehow that has to be done programmatically if you want to fully automate the deployment of that app. And that's where it brings in, you know, the questions around scripting and whatever else and how you deliver that. And to me, it just seems a little bit more difficult, quite honestly. And I think that's an interesting inflection point of how things that were built without automation were better. But then when you cross over into automation, not necessarily saying it makes it harder, but it makes it different, because now I've got one way to deploy three servers of the four server stack, and then I have to write some code that creates a database instance, and then somehow the app attaches to that with yet more scripts. Pretty tricky, frankly.
So going back to some of the stuff you talked about, Chef and Puppet, obviously those come from organizations that created them. The guys that are using them at scale are doing it at internet scale. Are you hearing a lot of enterprises using Chef and Puppet and these very robust automation types of tools to deploy their applications, where this is still a very small subset of guys who kind of believe in that religion at this point?
And real quick, before you go into that too far, explain to, for those of you that may be unfamiliar, like myself, a little bit about Chef and Puppet and what they are at a very high level as well.
Well, let me answer the first question first. I mean, I don't see much of it, quite honestly, but then again, you know, I mean, I think there's definitely two different types of enterprise now when we use the word, and one is the kind of the new enterprise, like the, you know, the Zingers and the Netflixes, and, you know, organizations that have built internet scale because that's their business. And I think you've got the traditional enterprises, you know, kind of the Fortune, you know, the old Fortune companies, who are ever finding new ways to be innovative. Try saying that after no drink. Innovative, but in the constructs and the confines of whatever they've dealt with before, which is kind of pushing the legacy forward. So I think to answer that question, I don't see much of it, quite honestly. And I firmly believe that's because of a couple of reasons. One, because the application or the general, you know, infrastructure and application technologies being employed by the traditional enterprises are probably not as easy to deal with, you know, as these new ones that are built out there. And I, you know, you can kind of imagine where I'm going with this. But if you look at most enterprise server-side deployments in the traditional sense, they're certainly not based on kind of the same technologies that are employed at Netflix and other organizations that have done it a different way. So you can kind of see where I'm going with that. So I think it's just a little bit different, I guess. You know, we've all been to writing, you know, scripts forever and ever to do all sorts of things, you know, but not necessarily for the kind of the hardcore automation. And I think it also comes back architecturally, you know. I mean, these things that are built for eventual consistencies and built for web scales, you know, they're not built on the same architectural foundations, you know, as relational databases or middleware that, you know, wasn't built to scale. It was built to do a specific job and it does it relatively well. And then you come along to wanting to be able to automate that stuff, and the automation options and the tools are a little bit different. So again, not saying it can't be done, because it certainly there have been successful examples of it, but I'm just not sure that I see lots of it. So that's kind of on one side of it. But if you want to, you know, just kind of very quick overview of kind of the chef and the puppet or whatever. I would say that, you know, essentially it really is about automated server infrastructure. And so kind of means a lot of things to different people. But the way I would kind of explain chef really is that you kind of code how you want the infrastructure to be built. And then you kind of take those descriptions and then you make servers out of them.
So Aaron, here's the way I'd put it in terms of to make an analogy maybe, or to put it in a different context. Think about, so you're a VMware V expert, you hang around in that community quite a bit. How many of the guys that you know that are V experts, for example, that live and breathe that stuff, do hardly anything with VApp or vCloud Orchestrator or any of those tools beyond just scaling vCenter and you know, VDI and some of the things around that space?
Oh, absolutely. It's an everyday kind of occurrence that certainly you go down the path of anytime you kind of get a new project, it's like, oh, wow, I could do something with Orchestrator. That'd be really cool. Or I could do something with VApp. That would be really cool. And then at the end of the day, you don't.
Well, I think what it comes back to, it's, you know, the thing we've talked to a million times, which is like you've got infrastructure guys who have lived below the applications, and then to make the applications do a bunch of these cool stuff, you've got to put your coding hat on to a certain extent, or at least your Uber scripting hat on.
Yes.
And Christian, I know we've had Nick Weaver on a couple of times, and I know you've mentioned that you and Nick sort of have similar backgrounds and stuff. How much do you run into that wall where it's like you almost have to take your infrastructure hat off and put your sort of at least coding / scripting hat on to figure out how to bridge these two worlds together?
Oh yeah, I mean all the time, you know. And I won't say it's a new problem, by the way, you know, because if you take sort of cloud out of it, you know, that thing around trying to write scripts to automate stuff because, you know, pieces of the infrastructure didn't do what they were supposed to do or didn't quite have all the right pieces in it. I mean, that's something we've been doing for the longest time, you know. And when we did our first Zen server, or in fact it wasn't even Zen server then, it was the first Zen source stuff back in 2005, 2006, whatever it was, you know, we were writing scripts to lay down that stuff on bare metal, you know, and we've carried on doing that. So, you know, and that's not there today in the commercial product. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just when vendors put out platforms and you know, kind of put out solutions, I'm sure they can't possibly consider every conceivable use case. And I think that's interestingly why, you know, APIs have been relatively important, especially latterly in some of the things that have been coming out, because it makes it very easily extendable to things that are just a little bit out of the norm, or, you know, this is the way I do it with my work process, or this is the way that we do it in the XYZ organization. So I think I'm probably not to the extent that Nick does it, because, you know, I think he's a little bit unusual, but yeah, you know, I mean, it's been happening forever, you know. And go back to batch files, you know, and in Windows environments, or, you know, go back to PowerShell recently. I mean, it's all the time.
And think about this. It comes down to this problem. It very simply comes down to opportunity cost, right? If you take somebody who doesn't have a background in this, it may take you longer to learn the tool and develop the initial release of something that far outweighs the cost of any time savings you get from actually automating something, right? It's am I going to automate this one time, two times, 10 times, 1,000 times? And also, how long will it take me to actually perform this automation? You know, Nick Weaver can probably kick something out in an hour that would take me a year to do. And that's just the way it is, right? He has a different background and a different skill set.
So sort of knowing that's the case, and let's shift gears a little bit. You were out at Interop in the Enterprise Cloud Conference ahead of time. You're kind of getting this feel for, you know, what enterprises are doing, where they're going. Obviously, for anybody who's been doing this for a little while, they're hitting similar kind of roadblocks or bumps that you're running into in your regular life, which is like, okay, cool, I've got an IaaS framework, I know how to get things deployed, I'm trying to figure out how to bridge it with other clouds, how to kind of expand that. And then, you know, you get into what you were talking about, which is like, okay, there are other services that are out there, whatever those might be, and probably the best way to interact with them is going to be through APIs. So as you went from Interop Enterprise Conference to GlueCon, which is the, you know, the big API conference, how are those guys looking at the world? How are things different? Where did the Lego pieces start plugging together? I mean, is there frameworks for APIs? I mean, I keep hearing numbers about, you know, there's a million APIs, there's 1,500 APIs alone coming out in the latest release of iOS 5. And I mean, how do people make any sense of where to start? What are the right APIs to code to? Do I code them in REST, in something, you know, in JSON? What in the world's going on there?
So there's a couple of things that I'm, you know, obviously we're very close to this for a couple of reasons. And one, you know, is around looking at APIs that are in products that we investigate and ultimately acquire. And that's kind of important because, you know, from an interoperability perspective, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we might do things slightly differently and other organizations do the same thing. So, you know, looking at APIs as a consumer of them is kind of interesting from one perspective, but then looking at APIs as a potential provider of them is also incredibly interesting. So I was really at Glue for the latter, but you know, if you want to just sort of spend a couple of minutes on the former, I think
what do you mean is, what do you mean as a provider? So you're sort of saying to your lines of business then for your
So you know, I mean, if you kind of think about logically what comes after, you know, you've kind of done a lot of data center consolidation, you've done virtualization, you've done some of the automation and orchestration we're talking about, you know, for the most part, enterprises are still talking, you know, you're still dealing with the same applications, right? They're just in a better framework, to put one of a different word, or, you know, you've managed to herd the cats and you've got some efficiency out of it, which is all great. But then the next question, and I think it's driven by, as we've talked about before, I think on the other podcast, you know, there's this huge thing around consumerization, and, you know, IT professionals and you know, geeks like us who are in this industry, we kind of understand all that. But relative to what's really going on out there, you know, it's very powerful for businesses to suddenly realize, hey, you know what, this mobility thing might not be as big a problem as we think. It might actually be a huge enabler. And so when people have gotten over the fact that it's going to be okay to let people use their iPhone for work email, or it's going to be all right to use your Android or whatever it is, then at some point people kind of figure out, hey, there's a pony in this somewhere, because if I can get my email on it, what else can I get on this? And, you know, why can't I get access to this application or this system or whatever it is? And I think, interestingly enough, that's where the API, you know, the framework of APIs as a provider becomes relatively interesting to businesses. And by that, I mean, you know, in the same way that I can request and respond with data from the Twitter API, why could I not do the same thing for a business data set that would allow me to essentially be able to write a much more lightweight, much more portable UI that doesn't require me to re-architect, re-implement, redo the whole application, because I might want to break it down more manageably. And that's kind of where the API strategy sort of comes in for, you know, me as the provider of the API, not just as the consumer of it relative to a Twitter or a vSphere API or a Zen API or whatever. So there's two very different ends of the spectrum that I look at it for. You know, one is for an interoperability thing with from our systems and other systems that we want to build with products we buy. And then the other one is, how does that help drive the business forward? Because we have a highly mobile, highly distributed environment. It makes all the sense in the world to start looking at them. You know, so that's kind of the two use cases of the APIs as I see it. And obviously been a lot of successes with many APIs or the API of many companies that are out there. But I think it's what's really interesting is the fact that there seems to be some normalization around API standards as well, both from kind of the method, if you like, or the architecture of the APIs, and then also some normalization around the security of it. So I think what we're seeing at the moment is that obviously REST is becoming the latest fanboy of all APIs, and that's kind of a good thing, because it is relatively simple and a relatively powerful framework. And then, of course, we're seeing OAuth be very prominent on the security side. Taking away, from an identity perspective, I mean, taking away, you know, the kind of the mutual TLS and all other pieces that are sort of part of the security. But yeah, just from a kind of an identity perspective. So, you know, we're seeing REST and XML and JSON. And I think JSON is probably becoming more and more prevalent in the examples that we see of how to write, you know, good APIs. So, you know, any APIs that are out there that are REST and have JSON or XML support and also have built-in support for OAuth 2.0. I think that's becoming kind of the where things are gravitating towards. So, you know, in the day job, that's what we've been looking at to be on that provider side. And then any on the consumer side that we talk about or we talk to in terms of other organizations that are providing software to us, just to make sure that, you know, kind of we have the same flavor of everything. We're sort of pushing that in the same way that we work with a lot of organizations recently to include SAML 2.0 support for web SSO. If you kind of move it away from, you know, a browser interaction with a web app and that whole SAML piece, and you kind of take that further to the right and say, well, okay, now there's some API piece to that within the web app, what happens there? You know, we're finding that OAuth is doing a pretty good job for us there.
And you guys are trying to, I mean, ultimately, when you talk about SAML, you talk about OAuth, you just want to get to a point where people just say, come in once during the day, I'm on whatever my favorite browser is, and the applications just work. I sign in once, it knows who I am, it personalizes it, it just works, right? That's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, that's the goal, absolutely. And, you know, and the goal is to extend that experience down to, you know, any kind of device, whether that be, you know, tablet of your choice and an operating system of your choice, or whether it's a browser of your choice or whatever it is. I mean, that the idea of that is to try and, you know, obviously we take tailor it to the experience of the device, you know, whether that's a native app, HTML5 app, whatever it is. But that whole thing around, you know, kind of SAML, OAuth, and then the kind of the REST-based APIs with the JSON payload stuff is kind of, I wouldn't say the standard, because I think that, you know, the whole thing around API standards is a whole other discussion. But, kind of moving back to the management space for a minute, I think it's really interesting that there seems to be, you know, that whole focus around the EC2 API, you know, in quote yep. mark, and there seems to be an inordinate amount of time spent on navel gazing around what should be the standard API, you know, because at the end of the day, it's a bit like Hoff said the other week, you know, I wish when he and I were talking at Interop or Glucon, I think it might have been, he said,
yeah,
you know, I wish
they all blur together.
Yeah, they all blur together. Yeah, yeah. So he basically said, you know, I wish Amazon had put out a cloud security API, because then at least everybody would copy it. Right. I thought that was a really interesting point, you know. So I think, yeah, I mean, should there be a standard API for the cloud management stuff? I don't know. I mean, there should be one that is compatible, I would say, or at least, you know, something that's compatible. But I think we're spending far too long worrying about that, quite honestly, in that particular instance.
Yeah, and you bring up an interesting point. We had Rodrigo Flores from NuScale on recently, and he kind of boiled it down to, there doesn't have to be one API. There just needs to be a manageable amount of APIs. It could be 3, 4, 5, as long as it's enough to where you can cover the majority of the market with a tool, with the APIs that are out there, he's okay with that, right? It doesn't have to be one. There doesn't have to be one API to rule them all.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, because that's when you end up running into the, you know, the whole last generation of how we dealt with standards and how standards became standards, which of course has got its place, but there could be a great deal of unintentional damage done by trying to put things through those old methods, you know, and I'm kind of with Rodrigo on that, absolutely. I mean, why does there need to be one? You know, if you look at the Twitter API, for example, which is always used in the singular, there's actually three APIs underneath Twitter. You know, there's a search API, the streaming API, and blah, blah, blah. So it's kind of interesting, because when you actually get into APIs, you know, you realize that, you know, if you've got a set of manageable APIs, then it really comes down, in my mind, to the adoption of those APIs is really driven by the, you know, the quality of the documentation, the quality of the error messages, just things that are, you know, and then the complexity of the method and whatever else.
I think it becomes a barrier to entry at that
point.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, there are, and that's, I think it's absolutely critical, and it's kind of interesting, which is, you know, if you look at guys that are out there in that API management space, you know, the Apigees, the Masheries, you know, the Three Scales, they're doing a really good job of inadvertently forcing that kind of rigor around documentation. You know, Apigee put out their developer portal, for example, you know, and they've also built in a really cool new console feature where, you know, would-be developers can actually test, you know, your API. You know, they can fire OAuth tokens at it, they can fire different methods at it, and see what they're going to get back, you know. So that, I think it's really important that, you know, nobody wants to write against a crap API, right? I mean, it would be dreadful from the developer's perspective. And I think if you have a business, you know, that monetizes that API, I think it gets even more critical, because, you know, your idea is to attract the developers, because that's the whole purpose of your API.
That's got to be a weird world for some of those guys that are actually documenting the API, because I can't think of anything that developers hate more than having to document their code, document what they do. It's like the gateway of last resort for the shit. I wrote this code, it works. Now somebody wants me to document it.
Well, absolutely. But I think, you know, what's interesting, if you pick any company who's basically has an API and that's their business. So something like a Twilio, for example, guys might not know who Twilio are, but essentially they do some really cool voice-based and SMS-based transactional systems that you can kind of interact with if you have any reason to want to use those as web services within your own application. And given the fact that that's all they do, that is absolutely all they do. You know, that they don't sell any software, they don't sell any widgets, they don't do anything other than provide access to their API, which is kind of monetized. Their documentation is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic, and it has to be because if it wasn't. That's their business, absolutely. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's in the same way that you see, Apple, Microsoft, whoever, do a very good job of productizing documentation or productizing software that comes with great documentation. It's kind of the same thing, with the exception of the fact that, there's really no software to download, install. It's essentially the API is the business.
Right. So we've talked about infrastructure management. We've talked a little bit about the Instratuses and the right scales for sort of multi-cloud management. Let's sort of go to the goo in the middle, the creamy frosting sort of the Oreo cloud cookie. What are you doing with the new platform as a service? I mean, like, what's interesting to you? What makes sense to you? What's still confusing between what some of the existing guys were doing, the Herokus, some of those folks, and what things like Cloud Foundry are doing? And I mean, it feels, the one thing that it feels like is, it feels like there are more and more choices, whether they work or not, but it feels like there's more and more choices that say, if you want to start developing new applications in this way, you're going to be able to do it either in-house or on some, public cloud platform, which I think is probably a good thing. And now it's just a matter of figuring out, do I want to write applications and which framework do I start with? Kind of where you're seeing some of this, or is there some interesting angles you're finding with this whole space?
Well, yeah, as we said a little bit earlier, it's kind of very early in some of this more, what I would say, advanced platform as a service stuff. And by advanced, I really mean in terms of the number of languages that the platform supports. So, if you kind of look at the ones that are out there today, or the big ones that are out there today or emerging today, there's pretty much, support for every language you would come across as an enterprise, right, kind of IT guy. Again, it might not necessarily be the same if you're coming from that whole web scale thing, but by and large, if you kind of look at what's out there with Cloud Foundry, with Azure, with OpenShift, and the other ones that are obviously Heroku, I'm not quite sure where that'll end up, but
it's Java, it's Ruby, it's Rails,
it's PHP, absolutely. And I think what's really interesting, if you look at Cloud Foundry specifically, they've just added some support in there for Scala and a couple of other things, and that's being driven by the community demand, so that's kind of interesting in and of itself. But I think, one of the things that is really interesting, or there's a couple of things that I think are really interesting at the moment, one is this question around, does PaaS require IaaS? And I don't think there's a clear answer for that at the moment. I think if you kind of look at what will probably be the obvious thing that happens with Cloud Foundry is that, at some point it will be bundled, or it will be designed, or it will be offered to run on vSphere, because that sort of makes sense from a VMware perspective, especially, if they want to sort of make money off supporting that as part of the, kind of it's open source, but here's how we monetize it, which is great. And then if you look at what's happening with OpenShift, which is currently I guess it's in a quite sure what you'd call it at the moment, developer preview or whatever the correct terminology is, but that's running solely today on AWS, but will ultimately one day run on top of the CloudForms platform, which is the Red Hat's IaaS offering, which is not come from out of the wrapper yet. And then you've got Azure, of course, which kind of nobody really knows what runs underneath that, relative to the fact that Microsoft have kept it pretty tight, and only recently kind of allowed you to actually get access to any of the servers at the lower level that were actually constituting kind of the Azure platform. So I think the demand is obviously there from the developer's perspective, because in the same way that they wanted to acquire the infrastructure as a service stuff from Amazon and from their own environments, and then get that instant access to servers which then they could build the applications on, the next thing for those guys is to really not care how that all runs and just be able to take your code, attach it to or upload the code, attach it to a service, whether that's a NoSQL instance or a MySQL instance that's running as part of the platform as a service, and then be able to very, very simply and very quickly update code bases, kind of apply patches or whatever it is they do. Having all that in their nominal control is kind of an obvious thing for the next generation of devs to want to go after. It's going to be interesting, I think, to see whether Microsoft finally get that that. You know, so let me switch that for a second. So, you know, for Cloud Foundry today, I can go and download that from GitHub and I can install it in my own environment. I can play around with it. I can do some cool things with it on premise. You know, I can use the one that VMware are allowing for kind of the developer preview. But I think in the background, you know, what's been interesting is watching Microsoft onboard some other partners, and Fujitsu was the first one, as we said a little bit earlier. I think ultimately, and I may be wrong here again, but that would seem to suggest that might open the door to an eventual on-premise Azure appliance, which could be very interesting because, you know, then I could really build these applications that are truly portable between, you know, a Fujitsu Azure, a Microsoft Azure, my on-premise Azure, you know, just using the sort of the fabric in between to move those pieces around. And so, you know, again, like we had the conversation about, you know, the kind of the cloud.com versus AWS, an on-premise thing, of course, would always require my ops guys to be clear about how that underpinning works. And I think there's a hell of a lot of complexity that nobody really wants to truly admit in any PaaS platform. So I think there's a whole maturity curve that needs to come up before I think traditional enterprises will be comfortable with operationalizing any PaaS platform. But certainly from, you know, we see a lot of interest internally from the developers because, you know, all they want to do is write great applications and they don't care about any of the underlying pieces. They just want to run the code.
Yeah, it's interesting. You brought up a bunch of points that Aaron and I have talked about on other shows. I mean, the first one was that whole idea of do these new PaaS platforms require, in essence, a VM or any sort of, you know, existing type of infrastructure, which, you know, forget about the technology of is that good or bad. It makes it very interesting from a business model perspective of somebody like VMware, where that's their bread and butter, and did they just release a product that doesn't require their cash cow? You know, the other one that's interesting to me, and you bring this up again, is, you know, if I can run stuff in theory, at least kind of anywhere, and you still have a good chunk of enterprises that are kind of fearful of, you know, the lack of transparency or stability or whatever their reason is for maybe not using some of the public cloud services. I've heard a million businesses say, look, you know, if I could get that and run it in-house and have a sense of it, the question becomes, like you said, can their operational teams figure out how to run these dynamic environments if you let the developers loose on it? The way I always kind of characterize it, and tell me if you think this is sort of right or wrong, if the infrastructure as a service wave is pretty well defined, it's kind of crested and it's moving forward, and you have this little tiny platform as a service wave coming up behind it, and it's just going to be a matter of how long one stretches out and how quickly the other one starts to build up. Do they crash into each other? Do they just look like normal technology waves that we'll be talking about PaaS as a mature thing 2 or 3 years from now, or do you see them as, you know, going in very different directions?
What it boils down to, again, just from when I look at where this is all kind of headed, is that people will pick the right platform, the right infrastructure, the right software as a service to do what it is they're trying to do. I mean, I think it'd be really strange for anybody to suggest that, you know, everything will all be software as a service, or everything will all be infrastructure as a service, or everything will, you know, as if it has to be put in one box. So, you know, I think what, oddly, that we get back to the interoperability thing, but, you know, I think the key to it really, in my mind, will just be, you know, how portable things are, and, you know, whether that means moving from one infrastructure as a service provider to another, for whatever reason that is, and the same with the platform provider, you know, and the same with software as a service. And each one of those has got its own challenges, you know, from technology stack through to lock-in concerns through to how contracts are done and all these other things that are out. But, you know, I just think it'll be opportunistic, you know, if organizations have the opportunity to move certain things to an AWS, well, AWS is great at doing what it does. Again, there are great success stories about people who have built their entire business on AWS, and there's great success stories about people who just use it for, you know, test and dev and then never anything else. So they're two very different use cases of the same technology, and that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, that, you know, it'll be opportunistic. And I think that if you kind of comment I made quite a while ago, I can't remember who it was to or whether that person was listening at the time, but my point was that if you think about enterprise, the enterprise CIO role in the next 2-3 years, I really believe that the CIO will be just become an aggregator of services, and those services will be sometimes internal, they'll be sometimes external, and there'll be a combination of both, you know. And I think the CTO or the technology leaders that help the CIO in that kind of supporting role will be doing exactly the same thing. You know, they'll be aggregating services from wherever they need them to be, and it'll all be really due to meeting the business demand and picking the right tool for the right job, you know, at the right place and the right cost.
So it's
yeah, and it all
comes back to your famous cloud concierge concept.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. You know, and I've still not managed to wrangle that domain name from the weary hands of whoever's sitting on it, but I'll get it one day. Yeah, you know.
Well, it all comes down to, again, it goes back to barriers of entry, right? No matter how big the project is or what kind of project it is. It's all about barriers of entry.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. You know, and within that, of course, you've got all the things around security concerns and risk assessments and, you know, data classification and all sorts of, I mean, all the things that you would have concerns about anyway. You know, I don't necessarily think that all those concerns will drive people one way or another to, you know, the lowest common denominator is, you know, this one, that one, or that one, and therefore everything has to fall in that bucket. I just think that's, you know, that's a crazy notion, and you know, it almost as crazy as the same way where people think that you're never going to stop the shadow IT department doing what they do, because, you know, this wave of the shadow IT department is a lot more tooled than the one that Nick Carr talked about, you know, and by that I mean a credit card in your hand now, you can go and start, you know, acquiring servers, storage, services without IT. And I think Vivek Kundra made a really great point when he said that, he made a great comment at one of the US IT government events, and he said that the more a CIO says no, the less secure his organization becomes. And I think that's just, if you read into that, it's brilliant. You know, if you think about what he's actually saying there, is that, you know, if you continue to say no to every technology, then all you do is empower and drive that shadow IT department to the point where you really don't know what's where. And, you know, I think it's a really powerful statement, and certainly one that resonates in our organization.
I mean, shadow IT has been going on for years. I mean, you know, early on it was the guys who would hang around late at night and get hours on the mainframe, and then, you know, in more recent times it was just people that would bring in a Linksys router and plug it in and not have to go in the conference room or something like that. So, I mean, this is just the evolution, and now they can get servers, and I think he's right. I mean, every time you know, and when you've got a... You've got all these generations of people coming into the workforce that know how to do stuff. You know, IT has to kind of reassess where they're going to add value and you know, how they move the ball, not just kind of like you said, be the guys who say no all the time. Aaron, with that, we've been talking Christian's ear off for a very long time here, which, you know, we did the first time as well. Maybe we got to wrap it up there. We can always come back to things, and luckily we know how to find him, and maybe we can get him back on again. With that, Christian, why don't we wrap this thing up? Aaron, you want to take us home?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Christian, where can everyone find out more about you?
So you can follow my random thoughts of the world on Twitter, which is Riley USA, R-E-I-L-L-Y USA, and then also at blog.theloosecouple.com. And it's been a pleasure as always, guys.
All right, cool. So you can follow us on Twitter at thecloudcastnet, or reach us at thecloudcast.net, where you'll find links to the show and show notes. You can leave us a comment or send us an email, and details on how to stream us on Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, have a good week.